From KPFK Pacifica Radio, this is Rising Up with Sonali, and I'm your host, Sonali Kolhatkar. You can watch this program on Free Speech TV and listen to it on Pacifica radio stations and affiliates nationwide. As Americans mark Veterans Day on Monday, the actual experiences of soldiers in wartime is rarely explored in detail. Veterans are valorized and romanticized, sometimes pitied and often held up on pedestals. Now a new book captures the experiences of World War II veterans and the war zones that they fought in through the eyes of the soldiers themselves. The book is Aftershock, The Human Toll of War, Haunting World War II Images by America's Soldier Photographers. And its lead author, Richard Cahan, now joins me. He's a journalist who writes about photography, art, and history. He worked for the Chicago Sun-Times from 1983 to 1999, primarily serving as the paper's picture editor. And he's the author or co-author of more than a dozen books, including Un-American, about the incarceration of Japanese Americans during World War II, and River of Blood, a book based on the interviews of formerly enslaved Americans. Welcome to the program, Richard.
Thank you, Sonali.
So you are co-author with Mark Jacob and Michael Williams of this book that we're discussing, Aftershock, The Human Toll of War, Haunting World War II Images by America's Soldier Photographers. Tell me about these photos. What is the rough time period when the photos were taken and who took them?
Well, this is a book all about 1945. In fact, the first photo in the book is taken January 1st, 1945, and the final photos were taken in the very last days of December 1945. And we chose that war year because it was probably the most violent year in human history. And we wanted to get a sense of what the world looked like. So we chose a group of photographs from a group of what we call soldier photographers. They were with the U.S. Army, and their job was to document what was happening and what they produced. They produced hundreds of thousands of images.
How many soldiers are we talking about here? And was photography their formal assignment?
Right. We're talking about a couple of hundred photographers. It's really hard to get a firm grasp of exactly how many photographers were working in 1945 because soldiers were coming into the Army and they were going out of the Army. And basically, they photographed wherever United States Army troops were. So we're talking about Europe, we're talking about India, we're talking about Burma, China, the Philippines, even the Middle East.
And for our TV audience, we'd like to show you some of these photographs as we're having the conversation. So these photographers, did they have a mandate for what they were meant to be documenting or capturing? Because some of the photos are of soldiers themselves, but a lot of them are about the people in the war zones, as well as other soldiers, prisoners of war. So were they basically given free rein to just document what they saw?
They did. They had something called an official photographer's pass. And even though they were attached to a certain unit, they were able to go wherever they wanted to, which made it very unusual for these photographs. And basically, they roamed the world. They roamed wherever troops were. They were almost always on the front lines. They were with the soldiers and they were with liberators because obviously the best pictures were pictures that were taken on the front line. So the war was really dangerous. Imagine going to war, armed with a camera instead of a gun. So they were very courageous people.
So it's not that they had cameras alongside their weapons. These soldier photographers were primarily photographers.
Actually, they were given sidearms, but very few of them ever used them because you can only concentrate basically on one thing at a time. And they felt that their mission as photographers was very important. Their job was to sometimes gather intelligence, showing generals what the front line looked like. And their job, they considered their job very historical. They had I think their first goal was to stay alive. But they write a lot about how important these pictures are for history. And here we are, 75 years later, after 1945, as we approach 2020. And their work is very important to us.
So how did you obtain these photos? Where did they come from? Have some of them been published before? What's the sort of unprecedented nature of this collection?
So all the photographs were deposited at the National Archives, which is a huge government facility in College Park, Maryland, that contains government records. And some of those records are photographic records. Anybody can go to the National Archives and request this information. So we didn't have any special permission. And so we looked through, I'd say about a couple hundred thousand photographs that were taken by this group of Army photographers.
Wow, so these are just publicly available photos.
They are, wow. They are. And what was exciting about this process was the National Archives gives people permission to scan photographs. These photographers use really large cameras with large negatives. I know some of your listeners probably don't remember negatives, but these negatives are 4 inches by 5 inches. They're filled with lots of information. And you can actually scan 10 of these images every day that you're at the National Archives. So this book has about 200 images, and we scanned about 800. So it was a long process, obviously, but very worthwhile, because you're seeing these images in a way that nobody else has ever seen them. Some of them have been in books before, but none of them have been seen like this, because we literally put these negatives on top of scanners and scan the imagery, and scanners and photographic negatives love each other. The negatives are filled with information, and scanners, as we all know, have an ability to just kind of capture every little pixel, every little dot from documents or from photographs.
Right. So since these are, these originally were obviously analog photographs, but taken with these very large cameras, there is, and the photos show a tremendous amount of detail. In today's lingo, they're extremely high resolution. Some of the images that I thought were really, really powerful were, of course, of the soldiers themselves. And I'm wondering whether part of your goal was to de-romanticize the experience of a soldier, to showcase, you know, the hard slog, especially in a year like 1945.
It was. As the title shows, the book is called titled Aftershock, which is a little more serious than aftermath. This was, the world was at a state in 1945 that it had never been at this, you know, at the end of such a war, and thankfully it's never been like this before. And then the subtitle is The Human Toll of War. We were really not interested in action photos. We were interested in photos that showed the impact of war. And that's what we looked carefully for.
So the photos where there's more of a stillness rather than movement.
Yeah, exactly. Photographs, you know, as I like to say, instead of using pictures of tanks barging into a city, we were more interested in seeing the wreckage that tanks caused. Instead of showing airplanes dropping bombs, we were more interested in the wreckage in Dresden and other cities, and obviously in Hiroshima and Nagasaki, we were interested in seeing the impact of war. I would say it's not a traditional war book. Some people have said it's an anti-war book. I guess it is, because obviously if you're looking at the toll of war, it's going to be anti-war. No one can show that and think war is worthwhile.
Let's talk about the people that are captured from the war zones. There's a lot of, or several places where there's pictures of women in the war zones where soldiers were. Often they are women who have been, you know, who've lost everything, and often have turned to the sex trade to survive and are considered prostitutes. How important was it to show that?
Well, I think it's an important part of the Pacific War, or not war, but what happened in the Pacific. So we were very determined to show that. I would say that this book, you know, it's not a pretty book in that we didn't, there are very few holds barred in these photographs. I think that this was a gift that these soldiers left the world, that they had documented this last year. And these pictures are oftentimes overlooked, because when you get war books, by the time you get to the waning days of 1945, the books are pretty spent. And we wanted, you know, we thought that this was the one chance to put on paper these remarkable images that other people had gathered. This is a gift, and obviously if no one sees that gift, then it doesn't have the impact that it could if it was in a book.
And of course, World War II is that war that has been sort of romanticized perhaps the most, the good war, it's often called. And the fullness of that experience is very hard to capture unless you were of course, actually there. Tell me about the cover photo of the soldier staring right at the camera. In the caption inside the book, you call it a thousand-mile stare.
Yeah, it's a U.S. soldier who's actually wearing a German officer's cap, and he's looking at what appears to be almost like lights in a Jeep. It almost looks like a deer in the headlights. And
he's sort of lit from below.
It's shot from below. And we had the good fortune. We knew his name. The photographers did write pretty, well, I won't say complete captions, but they oftentimes had the name of people. So this is Jack Pulliam, who was from Pennsylvania at the time. He was captured on his 20th birthday, and he was held in a slave labor camp and escaped the night that American troops came into the area that he escaped to. And he actually killed a German officer and was wearing his cap. And in all of our books, we really try to find out the information about the subjects. So we did track down Mr. Pulliam's. He's no longer living, but his son, Tim Pulliam, is living in Winter Park, Colorado. And I called him and asked him about if his father had ever talked about what had happened. And he said that he did talk about it. And he left a 19-page memoir that explained the experiences. And so we used that memoir to write the full caption of this picture. Wow. And it really does look like aftershock. It looks like he doesn't know. Here he's been, you know, he's just escaped escaped from Nazis, and he's confronted wearing a hat by his troops, and he didn't know if he was going to be shot at that moment or if he was going to be accepted. And he was very pleased. He said it was amazing that they just didn't shoot him as he was coming through the line.
Let's talk about Germany, of course, a very, very central part of World War II. And you have photographs of German prisoners of war, photographs of Nazi concentration camp and the Jewish prisoners that were held there. And all of this is in a book at a time when we're sadly seeing a resurgence of fascist ideology in Germany itself, to a small extent. Here in the United States, there are neo-Nazi groups that are on the march. And it's kind of shocking that at a time when we thought that this idea of fascism was beaten back, that it's rearing its head. And I'm wondering if you were thinking about our current political situation as you were putting this book together.
You know, I'd like to say that I was, but the truth of it is that war is something that's ingrained in humanity. You know, they say that every generation has their war. And one of the reasons they say they have their war is they forget how terrible war is. And so that was really the major reason. It wasn't about a specific, you know, time in history. But I think that these photographs will remind people this year, and I hope for many years, many decades, just how terrible war is. And I don't understand why we do it. War, you know, you talked about this being a good war. I think that all wars are a shining example of failure of humanity to figure out solutions in a pre-war state. So unfortunately, I think that this book is relevant today. I think the book will be relevant for years to come. I hope that as shocking as I think it is, I hope that high school students, if it's appropriate, can read this book, because high school students sometimes enlist in the Army, and when they were once drafted in the Army, so obviously they should know what they're getting into. And I think we should all know what we're getting into. You know, we live in an age, I think the book was written because right now the wars that the United States fights are very far away from most Americans. Obviously, they're extremely difficult for people who actually fight them. But if you live in the United States and there's a war going on in Afghanistan, the longest war in our history, or in the Middle East, it's not that it's convenient, but it's easy. And I want people to understand that wars aren't always easy. Almost everyone who was living in Europe was affected by the war, either by being victims of a bomb blast or being soldiers or starving. There's pictures of people in Germany cutting open a horse on the street. The war caused millions of refugees. Up to 60 million people died in the war. And I don't think that conditions have changed enough in society that I can safely say that this won't happen again. You know, the war was, we were brought in the war because of alliances, and alliances still exist. And we talk about war too frequently as if it's an option. And I guess if there's one hope, this book will help to convince people that war really isn't an option, especially these days.
There are notably very few images of people smiling in this book. Was that a conscious decision, or this was a reflection of what you gathered?
I think that there were pictures of smiling people that we didn't use in the book because there was a mood set by the war and by this book. And it's not to say that people didn't smile and joke, and you know, but this was a cruel war that spread across the world. And so, you know, we got more serious with the photo choices that we did. We tried occasionally, even though people aren't smiling, I hope that we always focused on humanity, whether it was pictures of a wedding among two prisoners in the Philippines and other pictures, you know, that ultimately war is a part of our humanity. And even though it's not a smiling part of our humanity, it's an important part that we shouldn't forget.
Were there any surviving photographers today? I mean, you said that there are probably just about a few hundred of these soldier photographers. Do you know if any continue to live today?
We did talk to one. His name is Ira Lewis, and he lives in Connecticut. He's about 98 years old. So the book is about 1945, and most of the soldier photographers in the books were their 20s or even their 30s by the time they went overseas and started taking these pictures. So they would be 95 to over 100. And unfortunately, there are few alive. Fortunately, many of them, I'd say a dozen of them, of people, photographers in the book, left behind memoirs, published. Some were published and some were not published. They left behind interviews with their kids. So a lot of our work was really tracking down the photographers and talking to their children, who, you know, as you can guess, are really proud of their fathers. And it was all fathers in this case, because they went to war with a camera instead of a gun. I think it's a remarkable thing.
Do you have a sense, and maybe you did from the memoirs, that these soldier photographers went through some of the same types of trauma that soldiers on the front lines who were armed and who were, you know, part of the battle forces experienced? Did soldier photographers, through their documentation, experience PTSD from the horrors of what they witnessed and documented?
I think they definitely did. These soldiers experienced worse things than most soldiers experience, although there's no scale here. Anyone who goes off to war will be affected forever. I talked to one woman who said that the war caused his father to be an alcoholic. Many people thought that the war had caused their fathers to be more gentle, which I thought was really interesting. They were playful, they were appreciative of life. Very few of the photographers that I talked to, or that his families I talked to, continued photography. You know, they had seen the worst with their camera, and there was really, I think in many cases, nothing much for them to photograph. One did work for Life magazine. One became a celebrity photographer. One became a great John Gutman, a great documentary photographer. But on the whole, they gave up their cameras, and many of them got involved with allied industries. They were printers and engravers and newspaper reporters. So they were certainly interested in the world, but I think that they thought that they had taken their, quote, best pictures, you know, of their career.
There are also a few photographs in the book, Aftershock, of Black soldiers, Black American soldiers. And I'm wondering what reflections you have in the book about segregation in the Army at that time.
We wrote a lot about it. African-Americans were, the Army was segregated, and African-Americans oftentimes were not allowed to get on the front lines. There were several infantry units that performed really admirably, and everybody knows about the Tuskegee Airmen. But it was a day where many African-Americans were consigned to work in the behind the line as cooks, as drivers, things like that. And, you know, again, it's a waste of talent and humanity and a sad chapter in America. We certainly deal with it. There weren't a lot of pictures that we came across of African-American soldiers in this group, and we included several, but sadly not enough that we came across.
And so I'm also wondering whether there is anything you can tell us about the technology of photography at that time, as you might have discovered in putting this book together. Today, you know, every one of us with a smartphone considers ourselves a photographer. We're able to document our surroundings and every minute of our life if we want, to an extent never before. But in 1945, first of all, that technology was rare, and secondly, it was expensive, and it was also cumbersome, right? I mean, I imagine the cameras themselves were quite big.
Absolutely, you're right. So most of the photographers, most of the photographs in the book were taken by what's called speed graphic cameras. They're the old kind of big box camera that you see in movies about the 30s with a press photographer, and he says, all right, you know, wait 1 second. And oftentimes in those movies, they use flash units because the cameras were very slow. They couldn't pick up light as well as cameras today. Obviously, the photographers did not use flash units very often in this situation. The last thing you wanted to do in the middle of battle was to call attention to yourself with a flash unit. So they were using big, old, boxy cameras, but cameras that produced these large negatives. The cameras were heavy. The cameras... oftentimes, you could only take a few pictures at a time. You literally had a large negative that you had to pull out of the container and start the process or contain until you process film. So there's a lot of miracles that are involved in this book. None of them that have to do with me, actually. The miracle that the photographers went out and took pictures, and they were so serious about what they were doing that they risked their lives every day. The miracle that they could, you know, take pictures and then somehow get these negatives back to headquarters and with captions, and that this material was organized in a way that people could see it during the war, and even more importantly now, you know, now that none of the pictures have been embargoed, that we can go back and look at these pictures. A lot of the pictures in the book have never been seen before, and the ones that have been seen, you are seeing it in like a new fidelity, I think is the best way to say it. It almost looks three-dimensional.
Finally, as far as you can tell, how did the soldier photographers see themselves? How did they view their, you know, their goal, their mandate? Did they see themselves as historians? Did they realize the historic nature of what they were documenting, the you know, what would become this sort of mythical war?
Yeah, I think that was one of the most interesting parts of my research in finding that many of them really did think about the future. You know, obviously their first concern was to stay alive, but they talked and wrote about how valuable this would be for the future. And I'm amazed that they had this kind of foresight, both in documents that they left at the time, because we were able to not only look at their photographs, but we then went back to the records of each of these signal photographic companies, and there's remarkable records of what they did every single day, and many of them. And there are mentions in their yearbooks, or not the yearbooks, but their company newspapers, how much people will enjoy this in the future. I don't know if the word enjoy is exactly the right word, but they did use the word that people would find it valuable. That's exactly what we felt.
Richard, I want to thank you so much for joining us today. I really appreciate your time. Good luck with the book.
Thank you so much, Sonali. I appreciate it.
My guest has been Richard Cahan. He's a journalist who writes about photography, art, and history. And he has authored or co-authored more than a dozen books. We're talking about the latest book that he has co-authored with Mark Jacob and Michael Williams, called Aftershock, The Human Toll of War, Haunting World War II Images by America's Soldier Photographers. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. We're online at risingupwithsonali.com, where you can sign up for our daily newsletter. Do follow us on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram at RU with Sonali.